Welcome to a full edition of After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. This first segment is going to be devoted to one of my new favorite writers. His name is Dean Jobe. Dean, how are you?
I'm great, Rick.
Yeah, I'm missed. I haven't read all of your books. I certainly missed Media Law in Canada, which was your first. But I got to tell you, the last three, as you well know, I totally fell in love with Empire of Deception. And after that, the case of the murderous Dr. Cream, who has a real history in Chicago. This one may top them both. He is nowhere near as evil as the other people. A Gentleman and a Thief, the daring jewel heist of a jazz age rogue. First, tell me, Dean, how you came about this. You write in the book, I think, in the acknowledgments that you were sort of researching con men when you came across this fascinating character. Is that right?
Well, yeah. You mentioned Empire Deception about Leo Kortz,
sure.
1920s Ponzi schemer in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I was looking to go back to something in the jazz age. It's the 1920s is so fascinating a period. And I thought maybe I could find another con artist like Leo Kortz. So I typed the words 1920s con artist into Google. And one of the early hits was a scan of a Life magazine article that called Arthur Berry the greatest jewel thief that ever lived.
Had you ever encountered him previously?
Not at all. And I have done quite a bit of research in that period. It was a stroke of luck he came up. He's not a con man per se, he's a cat burglar, but he did use a lot of he used fake names, and he lied about who he was and insinuated himself with the rich in New York. So he had a lot of the attributes of a con man, but fortunately, yeah, we came together.
But he also, I must tell you, I kept reading this thing, and especially I also want to talk about, I think in many ways that the media, including the Tribune-owned and New York Daily News, really fueled his reputation. But this is a guy who really appealed to me. And early on in the book, you kind of capture his philosophy of thievery. He says, "The thought of violence repelled me. People rich enough to own jewels never had to worry about their next meal." That's a rather benign philosophy for a guy who became a great, great thief, isn't it?
Well, he came back. He was a war hero.
Yeah.
He was recommended for a medal. He was a medic, saved soldiers' lives on the battlefield, was wounded and gassed, and unfortunately, one of the last to be demobilized back to the United States. So by 1920, when he's looking for a job, all the jobs are gone, and he literally started thinking, well, he was a bad kid.
Yeah, he was kind of what would later be called a juvenile delinquent.
Well, and that's right, and even Massachusetts law called it a stubborn child, which was kind of a quaint way of putting
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, he caused his parents a lot of grief, went to the reformatory, and had pulled some break-and-enters. So in 1920, when he needs a job, he literally, the way he described it later, he just started thinking about what he'd do. And he didn't want to take a gun and mug people, hold them up in the street. And he didn't want to work with accomplices and rob banks where he'd need help. So he just decided to get better and better at breaking into homes. I could see a progression from sort of sneak thievery to actually, going into people's bedrooms while they were there, holding them up, when he knew this would be the best chance that the jewels would be in the house and he could lay his hands on them.
That I found very, very brazen, and obviously he inspired some fictional characters. But also, Dean Jobe, as you write in the book, the Roaring Twenties was a perfect time to launch a career as a thief of distinction. That is so true. And he knew, he became, in a sense, talking about a con man, he became, a kind of frequent party guest, uninvited, of course, at some of the swankest estates, first on Long Island and then elsewhere. to my mind, such an appealing character. You must have felt the same way.
Well, one thing I liked about him is because he wasn't a thug. He did some pretty thuggish things. I mean, he breaks out of prison later.
Oh yeah,
he did carry a gun, but he swore he wasn't going to use it. It was just to keep the peace as he was doing his business. He was renowned for putting people at ease, calming them, sitting in the corner of a bed and saying, "Look, we're just here for the jewels. And, how was your night out?"
Yeah,
you know, trying to make small talk to ease the situation. And because he was targeting the rich and people who could afford these incredibly expensive, lavish jewels that were likely insured, it's not a victimless crime by any means. I mean, he's violating people's privacy and destroying their sense of safety in their own homes. But I thought that, this is a kind of an anti-hero that you can root for.
No question.
Because at his core, he was a decent man who just picked a very unsavory
profession. The other thing about it is if he had a problem, he had a gambling problem, did he not? That's basically
he was a
serious and not always winning gambler, and there were ample places to gamble in those days. That's why one of the great things about this book, Dean, is A Gentleman and a Thief, is it really does it captures the era in a fascinating way. What astonishes me, I mean, I know a bit about the Roaring Twenties, and thanks to, in part, F. Scott Fitzgerald, who's part of this book, too, and the shadow of Fitzgerald is all over the place, is that it was a time of unbelievable opulence.
And that's why it was a perfect time to be a jewel thief. There were lots of jewels around. I mean, there always have been. But the other thing appealing about Arthur Berry was just the way that his appetites mimicked the age. The way he put it was, it was the way it was an anything goes time.
Yep.
Everyone was trying to make a buck. If you weren't gambling at dice like he was, you were gambling on the stock market. And the way he said, it was the times. Why not live well? So he lived for the moment. He lived for the day. As you said, he lost incredible amount of money gambling. And when he was out of money, he just planned and staged another lucrative burglary.
He was so good at it. You write in here, Dean Jobe, every time Berry climbed onto a porch or placed a ladder under a second-story window, he was taking a gamble. He was not only betting he would not get caught, he was rolling the dice and hoping he would make it out alive. He was, I guess, a born gambler. We'll talk more about this fascinating anti-hero, I'm going to call him, Dean, A Gentleman and a Thief, A Daring Jewel Heist of a Jazz Age Rogue. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Dean Jobe is the author, most recently, of A Gentleman and a Thief, The Daring Jewel Heists of a Jazz Age Rogue. And on the cover of that book is a photograph of a man named Arthur Berry, who you will never forget after reading this book. One of the amazing things for me, Dean, and I respect you as a writer, stylist, and a researcher, is you recreate things. I'm talking here, I'm concentrating about his first robbery. He ducked inside, and as he suspected, he was in the master bedroom. He rifled a bureau, then opened the top door of a dressing table. A jewelry case inside contained a cache of earrings, pendants, and bracelets. Then you go on to describe it. Where did you find this kind of detail, Dean?
Well, it's a product of a lot of research.
Oh, but no question.
One of the keys to telling a story like this is there first-person, first-hand accounts from the people you're writing about. Barry gave enough interviews and actually cooperated with a biography in the early 1960s when he was long after he'd served his time. And so that episode came from that book. Mm-hmm. So this was Barry recalling it. So, you know, as a researcher, that's what I'm looking for because, I mean, I write true crime. I write nonfiction.
Right, so right.
I don't embellish these scenes. These scenes are all the product of what someone has remembered or, as I said, an interview. And fortunately, through my research, I was able to find lots of other interviews beyond that earlier book where Barry confirmed things and added to them. And at various times in his life, he was more willing to talk about things early on after his initial arrest in 1927. He was pretty mum about a lot of his biggest robberies.
Sure.
Robbing a Rockefeller, robbing the Woolworth heiress, Five and Dime Store heiress, and other crimes, out of fear he could be charged.
One of the things, that cache of information must have been astounding. You must have just gotten, your smile on your face must have just grown as you discovered, because this guy, the newspapers of the time covered his activities before and after knowing who he was, let's say the coverage was enthusiastic. Would that be the right word to use, Dean?
Fair enough.
Yeah.
The 20s, 20s was a time of exuberance on all fronts, and the media was part of that. And you mentioned the New York Daily News was America's first tabloid, founded in 1919. So it was hitting its stride, really revolutionizing the way, especially crime, was covered. The use of photographs and the kind of resources and reporters, skilled reporters, they would put on cases to sometimes be a step or two even ahead of the police. So the coverage was front page. It was often screaming headlines and incredibly detailed. And so Arthur Barry was, I've described him as a perfect dandy hero to read about. But for the newspapers, I mean, he was just the perfect celebrity criminal to focus on and tell his story.
And the New York Daily News, which eventually would become the largest circulation paper in this country, was a offshoot. It didn't imitate the Chicago Tribune, but it was started by Tribune folks. The other characters in this book who fascinate me are some of these detectives. Some of the cops and the detectives they're not equally fascinating, but they form a pretty colorful bunch, didn't they?
Well, one of the things I wanted to do, I figure if you're going to have a bad guy, you've got to have good guys chasing him. And I did know there were some private detectives who were on his trail, because the insurance companies would often retain private detectives. The police could be investigating, but insurance companies and owners of jewelry would often do their own investigations sometimes, and this happened at least once for Barry, because they would work out a deal with, if they could find where the jewels are, who had done the job, they'd do a deal instead of having a huge payout for the value of all the jewels. They get the jewels back, pay a little bit of a fee under the table, and get them back. But the aspect of this that really made it more like Catch Me If You Can was finding Harold King, the Nassau County, Long Island chief of detectives, who his career is just taking off. He becomes quite a renowned detective on Long Island, but ends up with one of the most baffling cases of his early career is, who is this guy, this burglar, who seems to be able to enter and leave estates and mansion at will? And a lot of rich people are not very happy to be dealing with this.
He eventually, Arthur Barry does. He's a lone wolf most of the time, but then he hooks up with a character named James Monahan, who I think they were a pretty interesting team for a while, but that team eventually had a big falling out. Why did he do that, Dean? Why do you think that he was so successful on his own? Why did he hook up with this? I don't like Monahan, and I just don't like this guy. I don't like this guy.
Monahan has this typically outlaw name, Boston Billy Williams.
I know.
His alias. Barry did explain that it was just getting more dangerous. He found that he couldn't be sure, as you said, as you quoted earlier, when he was saying that he couldn't be sure whether the next window he stuck his head in, there wouldn't be a gun pointing back at him.
Yeah, yeah.
He was shot at a few times. But he also found that if he snuck in, he could get some jewels, but there could be jewels in safes, there could be jewels hidden away, people could be wearing, women could be wearing their best, most expensive jewels. So it was a better approach. So after a few years of just sneaking in and out, he decided to be more confrontational, and that meant having an accomplice, someone who could help him keep homeowners in line and help him search for jewels.
Yeah.
But his choice was this childhood friend from Worcester, Massachusetts, where he'd grown up. And Monahan was almost the antithesis of the gentlemanly Arthur Barry. So why he teamed up with him, maybe he thought it was someone he could trust. They certainly had fallings out.
Oh, God, yeah.
And and ultimately, Barry would believe that he was set up by Monahan, and that's how he ended up being nabbed in 1927.
Do you think, Dean, this is almost a terrible thing to ask, do you think had you been able to at some point in your life meet Arthur Barry? He seems like such a likable thief. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, in a way I did on the phone, because one of his nephews,
right,
Gallagher, that I talked to, he says that that everyone tells him in this family that he's Arthur Barry. He sounds like him, he looks like him, same wry sense of humor, and, big storytelling Irishman. And so I did, and through Sean and a niece, Mary Schumacher, I was able to get a window, because they knew Barry.
Sure.
When they were children, they knew Barry, their Uncle Artie, they called him, and he was a sweet man. And they did find out bits and pieces of his background, and then the word in the family was, look, just don't talk to him about it. I mean, the family kind of wanted it to go away. It didn't, because there kept being feature articles, and Barry was cooperating with a lot of journalists. But there was sort of this wall put up that's happening out there, but within the family, he's just your Uncle Art. But they did help me get a measure of him. So he did live till 1981. But I am grateful that there was enough material, enough interviews with him, enough news coverage at the time, that I do feel I knew him pretty well by the end of it. And hopefully I can convey that to the
reader. Oh, there's no question you do. He writes, talking about that press coverage later on in his career, the Daily News, the infamous Daily News, launched the intimate life story of Arthur Barry, Prince of Jewel Thieves, end quote, an 8-part series of illustrated features billed as a complete first-person account of the, quote, reckless career, unquote, of the arch thief of the decade. That must have been a serious help to you in putting together the research for this book. The other thing that fascinates me about the book that we'll talk about after the news at the bottom of the hour, this is really a pretty compelling love story, is it not?
Well, it is. I started out in true crime, and because Barry marries in 1925, Anna Blake. Yep. She's an interesting character, and let's talk more about her.
There's also some fabulous stuff about prisons and the bleak state of prisons at the time. But we will discuss the love affair of this gentleman who was also a thief. We'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back. The star of Dean Jobe's most recent book, A Gentleman and a Thief, The Daring Jewel Heists of a Jazz Age Rogue, is a guy named Arthur Berry. He will remind you, I think, he reminds me a bit of the, maybe not as dashing, of the Cary Grant character into Catch a Thief, the 1955 film. He was also, the great thing, he went to prison, he escaped from prison, he was in love with a woman, and I think, Dean, it's a remarkable kind of love affair, and you capture it. You don't overdo it in here. You capture it beautifully. It's a real romance.
It was a bit of a challenge because Barry was very protective of Anna Blake.
Sure.
They married in 1925. She had been recently widowed. And by her account, I mean, she just fell for him head over heels and had no idea what he did. She knew he gambled. That explained why he could be flush with cash.
Mm-hmm.
And her attitude, she said to a friend, was, "I don't care what he does, I love him."
Yeah.
And it's his business. But in 1927, he gets caught by the police, and he gets caught with some odds and ends of stolen jewelry, and Anna Blake's with him. So she's in jeopardy of going to prison, and he does the gentlemanly thing once again, and he confesses, so she'll go free. So she's a really major part of the story.
I agree.
Barry didn't talk about her a lot. In fact, I was really, really surprised that his young nieces and nephews, when I interviewed them, didn't know he'd ever been married.
Mm.
I mean, it was sort of a little a secret within a secret. But she stood behind him. They lived as fugitives for 3 years.
Sure.
And again, there wasn't a lot of material on that. But as I dug, I found that in 1933, she did a 7 or 8 part newspaper series that was syndicated, very much like the one the Daily News did for Barry. And in that, she talks, and I've got her voice, first person, describing their strange, dangerous lives together, describing the arrest, how devastating it was, but how she resolved to stick with him. And it was just an incredible find, because I knew then I could tell this love story that is really crucial to the plot of the whole book.
When you quote her, you quote, and that's your quotes from her are really moving, and I'm assuming they were embellished by whatever writer she was working on, but they're still her talking. She writes, "We knew it could not last, but oh, how we cherished those precious 3 years. The gray future will find him changed and me changed. But when the prison gates finally open for him, I shall, God helping me, be waiting there." This guy was also the prime, this is the other thing that caught me so off guard. He was a prime suspect in the crime of the century, one of the crimes of the century, the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby. That took me by great surprise, but after figuring it out, I go, yeah, of course he was, because this is the most famous, ladder-using burglar in the world. Did that surprise you, too, or did you say, oh, of course he was a prime suspect?
Well, as I researched, I was starting to wonder who wasn't a suspect.
Yeah, exactly.
They settled on Bruno Hauptmann and the evidence against him. But the that was a strange aspect of this, that in the avalanche of coverage of the Lindbergh kidnapping, one of these private detectives that we'd mentioned earlier who was on Barry's trail earlier just started speculating. He was retained by the Daily News to be sort of their in-house detective to write about what would a detective do and to tell the police what to do. I don't think the New Jersey police appreciated it very much.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
One of the things he pulled out of the air was, well, this sounds like a Barry job. You know, used the ladder, went into a second story, nobody heard anything. I mean, yeah, this is what Barry did, but he didn't snatch children.
It's really
so from that moment on, yeah, he became a suspect.
Yeah, because he was also living in New Jersey at the time. Dean, I can't tell you what a great book this is. You have some wonderful jacket quotes on the back. You're going to be in town. You're going to be here on July 8th, which is a week from tomorrow, or maybe it's not. July 8th is the date. I don't know when it is on the calendar. And you're going to be interviewed at the one of the great independent bookstores in the world, the Bookstall in Winnetka. And you're going to be interviewed by Jonathan Eig, the recent his biography of Martin Luther King. Is a prize-winning, Pulitzer Prize-winning biography. You've known John gave a great quote to one of your previous books. Do you know John, Dean?
Well, we stayed in touch, and we've had dinner when I was in town. I've been to Chicago a few times for research or just to go.
Sure.
So we've kept in touch, and I was thrilled that he agreed to be in conversation with me, but I'm such an admirer of his work.
And, likewise, sure.
He's been very generous in his praise of mine.
And July 10th in New York, the one and only Karen Abbott, otherwise known as Abbott Collar, will be interviewing you. That's a good coup too. It's the big three of nonfiction writers, as far as I'm concerned.
No, it's good, and I haven't met her in person. We've talked about it, and we were planning to meet when I came to New York to do some research on Barry, and then the pandemic hit. Really looking forward to that event at the Mysterious Bookshop, which is such a wonderful venue.
You will be beguiled. Trust me on that. You will be beguiled by Karen. This book travels from Prince Edward, so it begins, where he's showing Prince Edward around the nightclubs of Prohibition New York, and kind of ends almost with him as a guest on The Tonight Show, and also being interviewed on TV by the young Mike Wallace. That covers the waterfront, as they say. Dean, you must be... It's difficult to take all the research material you must have had and then turn it into such a powerful, powerful narrative nonfiction book. Do you enjoy that process, or is it sometimes arduous for you?
Well, no, I really enjoy it. I mean, the research is like a treasure hunt, and it's a detective story.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a little mystery. You know, what was this place like? What was this character like? What was the background of this policeman? And you try to solve those mysteries as best you can. And the trick is to not overwhelm the reader with information. Is to just keep it to the essentials you need. But you're still building a world.
Of course,
I want readers to feel like they're being transported to 1920s New York. So there's some detail, but trying to always keep the story very. If I'm talking about Broadway and the gamblers on Broadway, and it literally sounds like Guys and Dolls. Well, I make sure I bring in the fact that Barry was like Nathan Detroit, always looking for a crap game.
It sounds like Guys and Dolls because it was like Guys and Dolls. Congratulations. Have fun with John Eig at the Bookstall in Winnetka. You can get a lot of information. You got a great website. Its last name is Job, but spelled JobDeanJobb.com. This deserves to be a bestseller. Maybe not all of us can aspire to Eric Larson like bestsellers, but go for it. That's what I say, Dean. Go for it.
Well, thank you very much, Rick.
My pleasure. It's great to read you.
Okay.
Good luck.
And take
care.
Great to talk to you again.
You too. Safe travels.